One of the questions that we get asked from time to time individually is about how we came to be here. How did you become a member of the Church of God? And I'd like to begin the sermon this morning telling you a little bit about my history. Some of you who know me know a little bit about my history, but I thought I'd perhaps give a little bit of my history because it bears on the subject of the sermon for this morning. I came in contact with the church when I was 15 years old. I didn't really know very much about the church. I knew quite a bit about the message of the church. I was a fairly serious-minded 15-year-old and was very worried about certain things. Those of you who are old enough to remember will remember the Cuba Missile Crisis and the Bay of Pigs invasion, all of those things that happened back in the 1960s. I was, the word is pretty frightened about the future of humanity and what was going to happen. And was there going to be a terrible nuclear war? And would all human beings die? And at the same time, I knew somehow or other, don't ask me, I hadn't proven it scientifically or philosophically, but I knew God existed. And I felt that in some way he was involved in my life. And then when I was 15 years old, I heard a voice on the radio who sort of tied all of those pieces together. And I'd never heard much about Bible prophecy before. But this voice on the radio explained that humanity was not going to destroy itself, that there was going to be divine intervention, and God was going to prevent that from happening, and after some very traumatic events, there would be a much, much better time. And I'd never heard anything like that before. Certainly never heard any message like that sitting in the synagogue. My experience of being in the synagogue was that when the sermon came up, the sermon was about the length of our sermonettes, and a lot of people headed out the door before the rabbi began preaching. It's true. It's true. Anyway, I began to write off for literature beginning at age 15, and it accumulated a very, very big pile of magazines and booklets. Some of you remember the old black and white booklets. I had a big pile of them. Read some of them. Some of them I didn't really understand very well. There were subjects that were not of very much interest to me. The subject that really was of interest to me at the time was the subject of Bible prophecy. I was not looking for a church. If you told me that at this stage in life I was going to be a Bible teacher and a minister in some church and living in the United States, what's more, I would have looked back at you as if you had a screw loose. But, you know, life leads us in unusual directions. I received certain pieces of literature whose titles I couldn't figure out. Is tithing Levitical? I didn't know what tithing was. I had to read it more than once and eventually figured it out and did begin to tith a few months after I came in contact with the church. I can assure you it wasn't very much money. It was, I think I took my allowance and divided it down to 10% and sent off a little bit of money to what was then Ambassador College UK Limited. Who is Melchizedek? I didn't even understand why that was important. Is this someone alive today? Anyway, I wasn't really looking for a church. I didn't expect that my own life would take this particular turn. Really, my passion right back then in my teenage years was Bible prophecy. And I hope I've learned a few things since then about subjects that are not necessarily directly related to Bible prophecy. But as you know, I teach a lot of Old Testament prophecy at Foundation Institute. My very first Holy Day service, my very first service was the Sabbath after Pentecost in 1975. I'd already been accepted to Ambassador College before I ever attended a Sabbath service. And this was about 3 months before I got on an airplane and left England and went to Southern California to study. My first holy day was the Feast of Trumpets in 1975. Now, those of you who've been around the church for a long time know that we sort of half expected something to happen on the Feast of Trumpets in 1975, and it was not that Ralph Levy is going to show up at a Holy Day service for the first time. Nobody argued that that had any great prophetic significance. But I remember being a little bit puzzled by all of this talk about how the church had expected that Christ would return on the Feast of Trumpets of 1975. Of course, he didn't return on the Feast of Trumpets in 1975, and here we are, how many years later? 48 years later. And when I go over some of these things with the young people at Foundation Institute, some of it is kind of dusty and mysterious history now. But some of you have been around the church for a long time, and I think you identify with some of that history. We've now got a generation, two generations, since that time when we conjectured that Jesus Christ would return in the 1970s. And here we are, of course, in the year 2023. Our Savior has not come back yet. Not yet, but he will. And we know that for sure. But what about prophecy? Prophecy is the subject of the sermon this morning. And I'm going to take a slightly different angle in this sermon. Again, some who've been around the church for a long time know that some of the publications that we had on the subject of prophecy have been derided and even mocked a little bit. Some of the things that we said about Bible prophecy. You can review them. It's all out there. Worldwide Church of God publications going all the way back to World War II. And things were said that I suppose we would not say in the same way today. We're a little bit more cautious about Bible prophecy. Reviewing some of those things, which I took a look at recently, I'm going to get to the subject shortly. Yes, sometimes we, the church, went out on a limb. Sometimes we were too speculative. Adolf Hitler is not living in the year 2023. Some of you may know what I'm referring to. We publish certain things of the like that we would not publish today. Often, if you look back at those old publications, phrases such as, in the next 5 years, you remember? In the next 10 years, there will be famines and everybody will be starving. In the next 5 years, there will be nuclear war, all kinds of things. Yes, we were too speculative and we got a little carried away. And yet, in reviewing some of that, it is my belief, and I think it's probably your belief as well, that the framework of prophecy of the Church of God going back to the Second World War is essentially accurate. I really believe that. Now, I know there was hyperbole there. I know Adolf Hitler is not alive today. You know all of those things. And sometimes those statements were put before the world in a way that had us going out on a limb a little bit. Recently, I was on the internet and roaming around, and I came across one of these websites. I'm guessing many of you have done this, the, quote, anti-Armstrong websites. And it's always struck me as very, very strange. You know, they're opposed to a man who died 37 years ago. Now, it's a long time. You know, it's a long, long time. But sometimes the world identifies us as, quote, Armstrongites. Again, for the young people here, that probably sounds a little bit strange. For the older ones who've been around the church for a long time, that maybe doesn't sound quite so strange. I came across a website which lists Herbert W. Armstrong's 209 false prophecies. I brought it with me. I'm not going to give you the URL. You're welcome to find it if you wish, if you don't have anything better to do with your time. But I went through some of these, and what struck me here is that many of the things that the church said back in those post-Second World War years about Bible prophecy were essentially true, but they were presented in a way that was premature. I dug down into some of the overstatements and found a number of ironies with regard to some of these things that this website opposed to our faith was actually saying. The title of the sermon is Not Yet. Not Yet. There are things that we knew were to take place in Bible prophecy, but we were off in our conjecture about when those things would take place. Those things are still ahead of us. A very, very difficult time before the return of Jesus Christ. And then a wonderful, glorious moment. And of course, our next holy day coming up this year is going to be the Feast of Trumpets. And it's something I think that we should all take very, very seriously when we get to the Feast of Trumpets and stop and meditate on the fact that what that holy day represents will be a reality. It's going to be fact. And our faith will become, in one sense, empirically proven for the entire world. Turn with me, if you would, please, to Luke chapter 12. Let's get to scripture here. Luke chapter 12. When I think about all of this and I think about prophecy, I think about this statement, this declaration from Jesus Christ. Luke 12, beginning in verse 35. You've read this, I'm sure. I've read this a number of times. But look at how relevant it is to our stance on prophecy. Luke 12 and verse 35. Jesus here says, "Let your waist be girded." You know, when a man in that ancient world had to begin moving quickly, running quickly, he had to kind of cinch up his robe. That's what it means here. "And your lamps burning." Got to have the light burning. "And you yourselves be like men who wait for their master." We are to wait for our master. "When he will return from the wedding, that when he comes and he knocks, they may open to him immediately. Be ready, be ready, be ready," the scriptures say. "Blessed are those servants whom the master, when he comes, will find watching." Watching themselves, watching what's going on around them. I think both thoughts are there. "Assuredly, I say to you that he will gird himself and have them sit down to eat, and he will come and he will serve them." Verse 38. And if, here's the relevant part, the striking part. "If you should come in the second watch or come in the third watch and find them so, blessed are those servants." In that ancient world, the first century world, the first watch was from sunset to 9 p.m., the second watch from 9 p.m. to approximately midnight, the third watch from midnight to about 3 a.m. You don't know which of these periods of time I'm coming. You won't know for sure. He will come and serve them. So blessed are those servants. Verse 39. "But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect." Now, of course, that doesn't wipe out all of the other biblical indications about the conditions that will be on the face of planet Earth when the Son of Man comes back. Nevertheless, there's this note of warning here. You can't time it. It doesn't work that way. You can't suddenly become more zealous 2 or 3 days prior to the return of the Son of Man. Matthew 24, verse 32. Let's go to the Olivet Prophecy, Matthew's account. Matthew 24 and verse 32. Matthew 24, verse 32. "Now learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near." Somebody was asking me about my fig tree before services. It's not producing anything this year. It was pruned a couple of years ago. It's got lots of leaves and little hard green buds, and I've considered whether to go out and curse it one morning. Verse 33, it'll produce next year. "So you also, when you see all these things, know that it is near at the door." So within the teachings of Jesus Christ, there are both notes. You see all these things and you know that it's coming, but you really can't time it as if you could sort of, you know, jump back into the plan because you know he's coming tomorrow. It doesn't work that way. And then verse 36. "But of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only." Only God the Father knows. I find that an amazing statement because the implication, of course, is that this is something reserved for the Father, and even Jesus Christ himself doesn't know the day and the hour. All right, with that as a preamble, what I'd like to do is to go through some of the things that were stated in this publication that I read, and I'm not necessarily recommending it, but the things that we've been sort of mocked about because they have not taken place yet. First of all, let's get what was written in this publication. The criticism was about this statement about the sea gates from 1956 onward after Suez. "Britain will never regain sea gates she lost." And then this publication points out an event that happened in 1982. And that event was perhaps not the biggest event in world geopolitics, but the Falkland Islands, which you may remember were invaded by Argentina and actually taken back by the Brits. Let's take a look at the subject of the sea gates back in the book of Genesis. Where does it say it in the Bible? Genesis 22, verse 17. Genesis 22 and verse 17. This is in the context of the revelation, the theophany given to Abraham. Genesis 22, verse 17. Blessing I will bless you, the angel of the Lord talking to him, and multiplying I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your descendants shall possess the gate of their enemies. Little points around the face of planet Earth where if you can control those points, you stand a much better chance of winning the next war. Now, this is given to Abraham. We shouldn't forget that. This was not given to Joseph or Judah, you know. So it begins with Abraham, and then it narrows down as we come down through the patriarchs. Genesis 24, verse 60. Genesis 24, verse 60. Genesis 24 and verse 60. This is the blessing over Rebekah. So they sent away Rebekah, their sister, and her nurse. I'm reading verse 59. And Abraham's servant and his men. And they blessed Rebekah, and they said to her, "Our sister, may you become the mother of thousands, of 10,000s, and may your descendants possess the gates of those who hate them." Did they know that earlier revelation given to Abraham? Apparently they did. And then they wish the same on Rebekah, who of course becomes Isaac's bride and his wife. Choke points. The modern world. Parts of the world, important little locations that bit by bit have slipped away and are still slipping away. Gibraltar. I've been there. I'll talk about Gibraltar in a moment. The Suez Canal. Hong Kong. And when you think about all of these points on the face of planet Earth, and you think about what's happened within the last, 30 years or so, you realize that the statement that the descendants of Joseph would lose the sea gates is actually turning out to be true. The Panama Canal. This website criticized the church for saying that Britain will never regain sea gates she lost. Whenever articles back in the 1950s, 1960s, whenever Britain loses a sea gate, it never gets it back. Well, 1982, the Brits took back the Falkland Islands as a sea gate from Argentina. Now, if you check the location of the Falkland Islands, really they're not as important geopolitically as Gibraltar or Hong Kong. Nevertheless, it's true, the Brits took it back in a war against Argentina. We'll come back to that in a moment. It's still a point of contention, by the way. The Brits and the Argentinians didn't restore diplomatic relations until, I think it was about 7 or 8 years after that war. Maybe it was longer than that. Hong Kong, on the tip of China. You read about Hong Kong in the news recently? Very dominant, very prosperous. It's had a kind of an ambiguous relationship with the mainland of China. It looks out to the Pacific Ocean. The Brits lost Hong Kong on July 1st, 1997, after 156 years of British rule. The last British governor of Hong Kong departed on that date. It was in the press. They featured it in newspapers and on TV. One nation and two systems guaranteed until the year 2047. That was what was supposed to happen. Now look, Hong Kong is in the news today. Hong Kong at that point was supposed to became a special administrative region of the People's Republic of China with a measure of autonomy, along with Macau and, they're hoping still, Taiwan. But if you check the news recently, what's happened over the last few years, the loss of freedoms, the loss of democracy. I think it was a couple of weeks ago that the last democratic internet-based site based in Hong Kong was shut down, in effect. They were forced out of business. It was Hong Kong that kept on for a number of years talking about the events of Tiananmen when there was a massacre there in Beijing. The wealthy began to get out. Some keep a low profile. And there has been, in effect, a pretty brutal suppression of anything deemed anti-China in Hong Kong. Press freedoms have disappeared. An independent judiciary barely exists any longer. And as I mentioned, this last pro-democracy website based in Hong Kong was forced out of business. They sequestered their bank accounts and basically ran everybody out of town. Were we wrong? Or were we simply premature? I suspect it was the latter. Hong Kong no longer belongs to part of the British Empire. It's now part of China and coming increasingly under the influence of China. Gibraltar. I visited Gibraltar years ago. I had a year in Spain when I was studying. And you know, back then, what you had to do to get to Gibraltar was interesting. You couldn't cross directly from the Spanish mainland into Gibraltar. Franco was still living, and he was mad at the Brits about Gibraltar, and he closed it off. You couldn't cross directly. You could look at it, the Peñon, the big cliff there, but you couldn't get directly across just walking across. You can now, although I think they have big, long lines of cars very often. What I had to do was to cross over the Straits of Gibraltar to Morocco. I spent a few days in Morocco and then crossed back going northward to get to Gibraltar. Gibraltar is really very strategic, and very much pro-British. If you read about Gibraltar right now, the young people are bit by bit loosening their interest in learning Spanish. They want to learn English and be what they are now, a UK foreign territory. But it's been a bone of contention between Spain and the United Kingdom for decades now. In 2002, the foreign minister of the UK, Jack Straw, suggested that there could be joint sovereignty with Spain in Gibraltar. It was put to a referendum because the inhabitants of Gibraltar didn't like the idea. Do you approve of joint sovereignty with Spain? 98.97% against. In other words, the population of Gibraltar, almost to a man or to a woman, said, no, we want to remain British. There's still a drumbeat of demand for El Peñon to be given back. We want it back, Spain says. The people who live in Gibraltar say, we don't want to be given back to Spain. This was, of course, impacted by the decision in 2016 that the United Kingdom would leave the European Union. Not surprisingly, Gibraltar voted overwhelmingly to remain part of the European Union. It facilitated the movement of people and goods and services back and forth. 93% of the inhabitants of Gibraltar voted to stay in the European Union. It's a lot more tenuous now. And there's still a drumbeat from Spain, we want it back. And the Brits are saying, we'll give it back to you when the people want to become part of Spain. So it's kind of a deadlock situation. It remains a British overseas territory. For now, we wonder about it. The Falklands, I mentioned the Falklands before, 1982. Now, if you ever go to Argentina, use the phrase Las Malvinas, not the Falklands. They'll get very upset with you if you talk about the Falklands, off the eastern coast of Argentina. The war in 1982 lasted 10 weeks. The Brits won. I'm told that there are more sheep than human beings in the Falkland Islands. I believe that to be true. But this is still in the news today, and it's a bone of contention. An article from BBC.com, Memories of the Falklands War Represent an Open Wound in Argentina, the country's ambassador to the UK has said. Javier Figueroa described conflict over the island's sovereignty as ridiculous, comparing it to the relationship between North and South Korea. Most young people in the UK do not know, quote, Britain has a beef with Argentina regarding the South Atlantic, he said. I don't know whether he intended that pun. His comments were made to mark the 40th anniversary of the war. 40 years have gone by. Speaking to the PA news agency, the ambassador explained that despite the 1982 war ending four decades ago, in Argentina it remains, quote, a deeply emotional issue. This is despite Falkland Islanders voting to remain a UK overseas territory. They had a referendum as well in 2013, a margin of 99.8%. You would be hard-pressed to find anybody living in the Falklands who said they wanted to become Argentinian. No, virtually nobody did. So it is still part of British territory. Perhaps a little more closer to home, the Panama Canal. I don't know whether you realize this, but 6% of all world trade goes through the Panama Canal. 16% of U.S.-bound trade goes through the Panama Canal. General Torrijos and President Jimmy Carter signed treaties, there's more than one, in 1977. And the handover of the canal took place on December 31st of 1999 from joint control to Panama. There was a treaty of neutrality. Panama is to remain neutral. And yet some of the things that have happened since then lean in a particular direction. The Chinese are becoming much more active in the Panama Canal container ports and so on. Growing influence of the Chinese around the canal. So these prophecies are actually coming true, aren't they? The choke points are being lost. Significant long-term difference. Now, it doesn't impact your life or mine on a day-to-day basis. However, in the event of another war, it's going to have a big, big difference. What would be the effect? The loss of Hong Kong, Panama, possibly Gibraltar. I submit that we were right on this, but it's just taking more time than we expected. The pushback against the domination by the Israelite nations in some of these critical points around the world. I want to give you a few quotes on another subject from this particular publication. Quote from point number 50, there's a whole bunch of criticisms in this particular article. 1957 to 1972, the Church of God said, quote, Britain will never join the European common market. Note, 1973, Britain joined the European common market. Number 51, 1973 onwards, Britain will leave the European community. Note, after 21 years, Britain is still in the community. This was written in 1994. Now, here we are, year 2023, and of course, you know the history since then. Number 52, the 1950s and the 1980s, the Church of God said, the European community would become a German-dominated tyranny. Note, in 1992, after 35 years, the European community remains the most democratic group in European history and dominated by France. Now, all of that is a bit debatable, of course. Just how democratic the European Union is was one of the reasons why the Brits voted to leave, because they felt it was not very democratic. And is it dominated by France or is it dominated by Germany? March 1950, Plain Truth magazine, on the United Europe, definitely Britain will not be in it. Isn't that interesting? 1973, Britain joins the European community. 1991, the European community becomes the European Union following the Treaty of Maastricht. Britain remains a member to this day. This was written in 1994. I was in England by coincidence in 2016 when the vote took place to leave the European Union. It's still a very, very divided nation, by the way. It's a subject that you don't bring up over dinner. 51.9% voted to leave, 48.1% voted to remain. Almost a complete split in a deeply divided nation. And now, of course, whatever you think of that as a political decision, the UK has the lowest economic growth rate of any of the G7 nations. It's struggling in many ways economically. And yet, let's take a look at something, and let's look at the reason why we said all those things. In actual fact, we turned out to be right, although it took longer, didn't it? Britain did exit the European Union. Let's go to Revelation 17. Revelation 17. Revelation chapter 17, beginning in verse 7. Revelation 17, verse 7. These prophecies are still there. These prophecies are still ahead of us. These prophecies are still going to be fulfilled. But the angel said to me, this is John speaking, why did you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. The book of Revelation, as we know, describes a conglomerate, religious, political, military. That's still ahead. And ten horns. Notice the number ten. The beast that you saw was and is not will ascend out of the bottomless pit. The Roman Empire comes back to life and go to perdition. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that was and is not and yet is. The world is going to marvel because this is going to kind of blindside most people on the face of planet earth. You and I know about that. This is something for us to keep in mind, to be well aware of. Verse 9, here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. Seven mountains. We know which city sits on seven mountains. When I lived in Cincinnati, Ohio, I learned that Cincinnati, Ohio is on seven hills. But this is not talking about Cincinnati, Ohio, okay? There's a city in Brazil that I think is built on seven hills as well. No, the subject here is Rome. There are seven kings, five have fallen, one is, the other has not yet come. There's an interesting verse as well. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. It's not going to last very long. One of the notes in the book of Revelation is reassurance for the people of God. This comes to an end fairly rapidly. It's going to be a time of great difficulty, but it doesn't go on forever. The beast that was and is not is himself the eighth and is the seven and goes to perdition. Verse 12. The ten horns which you saw are ten kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. These are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. That is not democracy at work. That is yielding up power to a European superman in a time of great crisis. We've understood this for a long time. We note 10 nations, 10 kingdoms. How many nations use the euro today? I'm tempted to give a pop quiz, but maybe it would be a bit unfair. 20 nations in the eurozone. 27 nations in the European Union are present, with other nations desirous of becoming part of the European Union, including, of course, Ukraine. Not 10. So we know from Bible prophecy that some things will change drastically between now and then. We don't know exactly what it's going to look like. We don't. But the church correctly understood that this European power, termed the beast, in the book of Revelation, would not be dominated by those who descend from the patriarch Jacob. The conclusion was right. We gave details that had us a little bit out on a limb. March 1950, Plain Truth magazine on the United Europe. Definitely Britain will not be in it. Britain now is not part of the European community. Now, that critical publication was written in 1994. In the year 2023, it seems a little prescient, doesn't it? Because Britain actually has left the European Union. As I say, if you talk to people in Britain, it remains a deeply divisive issue. There are people who won't talk about it. You know, we have political things that divide us here, but there are people who won't talk about it because it's still a very, very divisive issue. Another in the 1960s, the Church of God predicted that Russia and China would mend their split. They never did. Well, okay, not by 1994, and there were times when Russia and China were sort of at each other's necks, or the Soviet Union. And yet, what's happened more recently? A quote from the George W. Bush Presidential Center. At their Beijing summit in February 2022, Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin announced a, quote, friendship without limits. There were no forbidden areas of cooperation, and the Sino-Russian strategic partnership was, quote, superior even to the alliances of the Cold War era. Now, there's a lot that could be said about that. The Bible talks about certain nations, the Asiatic nations up to the north and up to the east, and these appear to have to do with Russia and China. Again, we know some of this from Bible prophecy. Daniel 11, verse 44. This was based on a good understanding of what some of the scriptures say. But the Bible is not always 100% clear. Daniel 11, verse 44, this is speaking about the king of the north who's come down to invade. And then there's news. And look at where it comes from. Daniel 11, verse 44. But news from the east and the north, this is presumably from the perspective of Jerusalem. News from the east and the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. What's going to come from the north and the east? Who is to the north and the east? Answer, Russia, China, and a number of other nations. Revelation 16, verse 12. Then the sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up, so that the way of the kings from the east might be prepared. Again, a hint of great nations from the east and from the north and getting involved in those very troubling events right at the end of the age. One more, a quote, August 1950, Church's publication. Quote, "The next pope will be a miracle worker, a supposed proof that God is using him to order and pacify the world." 1958 to 1962, the next pope was Pope John the 23rd. He never claimed to be a miracle worker and never tried to organize or pacify the world. No, it wasn't Pope John the 23rd. However, 1982, Pope John Paul II, actually, he was quoted by Pope Benedict in 2005, going back to Pope John Paul II in 1982. Pope Benedict said, the Pope pointed out during, this is John Paul II, the Pope pointed out during the 1982 visit, John Paul II launched, quote, "the project of a Europe aware of its own spiritual unity, based on the foundation of Christian values." Now, there's a definition there, of course, as they understand Christian values. He returned to this theme on the occasion of World Youth Day, 1989. The Pope continued, this is Pope Benedict, held at Santiago de Compostela, expressing his hope for a Europe without frontiers, a Europe that does not deny the Christian roots from which it grew, and that does not renounce the true humanism of Christ's gospel. How appropriate this call remains today in the light of recent events on the European continent. I want to interject a little comment here. When I was in London a couple of weeks ago, I went to see a show. My brother is a professional musician. I went to see Back to the Future, the musical. It's quite good, by the way. You don't have to go and watch it, but I don't usually go out to a lot of shows. Anyway, the theater was full, and I sat next to a couple of young people. To my right, there was a young woman, and then to her right, there was a young man, German-speaking, and she was very chatty. We entered into a conversation, you know, very, very friendly, and I learned that she was from, both of them were from Austria. Not a married couple, I'll get to that briefly, but from Austria, and they were in London for a leadership seminar for the Roman Catholic Church. And then she began asking me what I did for a living, and I told her I was a Bible teacher. She was fascinated by this, you know. She asked me more questions than Church of God members ask. But the conversation went on for a while, and then she made an interesting comment. This is what I want to quote. She was talking about the Roman Catholic Church, in particular about its influence among lots of people. And she used the phrase, her words were, "a sleeping giant." I think the phrase is very apropos. Because that's what it is. It is a sleeping giant. It's still asleep. We know from Bible prophecy that it's going to wake up at some point in the future. Let's go to Revelation chapter 13. A sleeping giant. She was very friendly. When we said goodbye, she said, "May God bless you in your work." And I was a very interesting. She was Roman Catholic, and she intimated the gentleman to her right was not her husband or her boyfriend. She said that she'd taken some kind of a vow of celibacy, and this was just a young person who was working at this particular leadership seminar for the Roman Catholic Church in London. They come across from Austria. We know from Bible prophecy that, again, this is an example of not yet. We're not there yet. Revelation 13, verse 11. Revelation 13, verse 11. "Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. He masquerades as a lamb, but his voice is the voice of a dragon." In John chapter 10, we are told that God's sheep know his voice. They know the voice of Jesus Christ. We recognize the voice of Jesus Christ. We hope, we believe, will not be taken in love by this, because we're going to say, it doesn't sound right. This doesn't sound like the voice of the Lamb. This sounds like something quite different. Verse 12, "And he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence, and he causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed," the Roman political power. "He performs great signs." Look at that. Here's an example in the Bible where someone who is not a true servant of God is going to work miracles. "He performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and who lived. So we've got this religious leader who looks like the lamb, wants to look like the lamb, but in fact sounds like the dragon. Hopefully, brethren, we in God's church understand, we recognize the voice of the lamb. We know that this will be a counterfeit. But for a lot of people, it's not going to be in the least bit obvious. Now, if you've been to Europe recently, and I think some of you have traveled for the feast, maybe on other occasions, you know something that we understand well. Europe is overwhelmingly secular right now. Religion is not a big-ticket item as it is, especially here in the south of the United States. Many young people in particular want to know nothing about religion. Nevertheless, the church has a lot of wealth, a lot of property. And I think the fact that people don't know about religion and don't know about the Bible is going to mean that when this happens, we just read it, didn't we? He's going to call fire down from heaven. And what's going to be the reaction of lots of people? Well, if he can do a thing like that, he's got to be a man of God. How could it possibly be anything other than that? Revelation 17, verses 7 and 8. The sleeping giant is going to come out of its slumber. Revelation 17, verse 7. The angel said to me, "Why did you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the 10 horns. The beast that you saw was and is not will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that was and is not and yet is." People are going to be amazed by this. We know Bible prophecy. I think we've backed off a little on Bible prophecy, but the main planks of what the Church of God has taught on Bible prophecy for decades remain firm and reliable. Now, there are areas where we're not sure. There are areas where there's speculation. There are areas where we have to be careful not to go out on a limb. That's true. All of that caution is well called for. Nevertheless, the main framework of Bible prophecy that brought many people into the church, myself included, is still there and is still real and is still ahead of us. Not yet is the byword. Not at all is not the byword. But there's one more yet to come. The big prophecy, the great prophecy, the one that hasn't taken place yet. And of course, we know what I'm referring to here. Let's go to Zechariah chapter 14. This is yet to take place. When the fall holy days come around, you know, we all need to stop and ask ourselves, do we really believe this? Do we understand what this means, what this will mean for the body of Christ, what this will mean for the world as a whole? We need to stop and meditate on those things, especially as we get to the fall holy days. We're not just sitting in church for all eternity. There's going to come a time when there'll be a culmination of God's plan and everything's going to change for you and me. Zechariah 14 and verse 3. Then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations as he fights in the day of battle. Jesus Christ is going to fight. Isn't the millennium a time of peace? Well, yes it is, but the moment the Christ comes back, there's going to be quite a bit of conflict until that all settles down. Verse 4, and in that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which faces Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall be split in two from east to west, making a very large valley. Half of the mountain shall move toward the north and half of it toward the south. Some of us have walked down the Mount of Olives. I've walked down the Mount of Olives a couple of times. You see the graves of the religious Jews there because they know this, you know. They know Messiah is going to come to the Mount of Olives. It costs a lot of money, by the way, to buy a grave on the Mount of Olives. Lots of, I don't know how much. I can't quote you a price. But it costs a lot of money. Jesus Christ is going to come back. The book of Acts tells us very clearly he will come back to the Mount of Olives. It's clear there in Acts chapter 1. The return of Jesus Christ. It's sure. It's certain. Daniel chapter 2. Daniel chapter 2. This is why we're part of God's church. These are prophecies which you can take to the bank and which I can take to the bank, on which we can bank our lives, our eternal salvation. Daniel 2, and I love the way Daniel phrases this in verse 44. Daniel 2, verse 44. In the days of these kings, this last formation of Roman dominance in the world, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It's not a human government. It's God's government. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. It's interesting. Daniel 2 intimates that there are remnants of actually all four of those great Gentile empires, Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. There are remnants of all four on the scene when Christ returns, but Jesus Christ will put down that last manifestation of human government. Verse 45. Inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, this wasn't of human origin, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. And these words for you and me, the dream is certain and its interpretation is sure. That's the big prophecy, the prophecy of the return of Jesus Christ. We still believe that. We will never relinquish that. In fact, we'll be vindicated when we see him coming back from heaven and he grants that promise of salvation to the saints of God, the ones who are in their graves at that point. We heard a little bit about that in the announcements, and the ones who are still living. Yes, we at times got a little bit too speculative. Yes, we went a little bit out on a limb. We said things that we would not express in that way in the year 2023. And yet, we are how many decades closer to the events that we published about back in the 1950s and the 1960s? Time is going by, brethren. Time is going by. And that framework of prophecy that the church has had for a long, long time is a true and sure framework of prophecy. Maybe we need to spend a little bit more time in our own personal Bible study looking at subjects like prophecy. One lady in England, I think it was last summer actually, one lady whom I've known for a while, she said, I don't like to read the book of Revelation, it's too scary. I just like to, you know, pull the blankets up over my head when I'm in bed and turn over and not read it. Yeah, it is scary. It is scary, and it's designed to be scary. But when the scare is over, much better things happen. 2 Peter 1, verse 19. To wrap this up, 2 Peter 1 and verse 19. I love the way Peter says this. 2 Peter 1 and verse 19. And so we have the prophetic word confirmed, which you do well to heed as a light that shines in a dark place. You live in a rural area with no street lights. You take a torch, a lamp out with you when you go out for a walk at night, until the day dawns and the morning star rises in your hearts. And the caution, of course, follows in the next verse or two. No private interpretation, but there are things that are not a private interpretation. There are things that we know for sure. There are things that God assures us will truly be a reality. Hebrews chapter 10, to wrap this up here. Hebrews 10. And verse 35, Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 35, Hebrews 10 verse 35. Therefore do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward. You have need of endurance, or patience, as some of the other translations say it. You have need of endurance so that after you've done the will of God, you may receive the promise. And then this fascinating quote from one of the Old Testament prophets. It actually comes from the book of Habakkuk. Verse 37, for yet a little while, and he who is coming will come, and he will not tarry. To us, it may look as if he tarries. Our lives are short. All of that time went by. Many of us expected that Christ would have been back by now, and he's not. Not yet. But he will not tarry. Now the just shall live by faith. But if anyone draws back, my soul has no pleasure in him. And then let's read verse 39 as well and wrap it up. But we're not of those who draw back to perdition, but of those who believe to the saving of the soul. Our understanding of prophetic fundamentals is, and I think always has been, accurate and true. And that, of course, is the great prophecy of the Bible, the return of Jesus Christ to take over the governments of this world and introduce something that is going to be much, much better than we even dream about.